my stock answer when people ask us how we met is I always just laugh and say we met at a bar, which is true. We met at a bar, but we met through a friend. He was a coworker of mine and a friend of Steve's. The funny story about that is that there are two other people who adamantly take credit for introducing us, but neither one of them actually did. This one person, Jeff, was the one who actually made the introduction. Steve, this is Maxie. Maxie, this is Steve. The next night, we ended up at a barbecue together. The initial meeting was, no offense, not that momentous. I mean, but it was the next night where we reconnected at a barbecue and kind of started really talking that night.
Back in that day, summer of 86, you know, we sort of had a Friday night happy hour ritual. And I had moved from Boston down to Pittsburgh in the fall of 85 with a job change. Had met some of the guys that Maxine worked with. I had met them socially. And so the routine was sort of to go downtown to start happy hour on Friday afternoons. And that's where I met Maxine initially, as she said, at the bar. And we chatted just for a minute or two that night. But the next day, coincidentally, we happened to wind up together at a barbecue. At the barbecue, we spent a little bit more time talking and getting to know each other. And then in sort of a strange coincidence again, the next Monday, at that time, all the guys got together every Monday night for wings and beer. Maxine happened to come that Monday night. So here we'd never met previous to that Friday, but here we run into each other three times in 4 days. And as I recall, as we kind of got towards the end of the night, both of us were still kind of hanging around, along with one other buddy of mine, a guy named Bruce Downing. And at that point, I'm deciding, okay, I want to try and see if I can ask Maxine out. So I, you know, posed to her, hey, you know, I've got nothing else going on now. It was about 8 o'clock at this point. I said, you know, you feel like going to see a movie? And Maxine said, yeah, sure, I'll see one. And I'm thinking, okay, great, we're going to go out now together to the movies, when my buddy Bruce pops in with, hey, sure, I'd love to go. So our sort of first meeting really rolled almost into a first date, and we were chaperoned with a very good friend named Bruce Downing on that first date. And my first sign that we were, a little bit of karma between us, was we both at one point went to say something to each other during the movie, simultaneously leaned in and had that proverbial head-cracking moment.
Hard one. It was hard. A very hard head-cracking. We both kind of went away like, ow, that really hurt, but it was funny. So I'd heard a lot about him from Jody and, you know, heard he was a nice guy. And so I thought, oh, you know, we'll give this a shot. And Bruce, I worked with. So when Bruce said, oh, yeah, I'll go too, I kind of thought, okay, that's good. And we continued to go out just for a couple months. And then I decided that we needed to just be friends for a little while.
Maxine mistook at the time the fact that I was actually a gentleman and a nice guy for thinking that that meant I was getting very serious very quickly. And that really wasn't the case. I mean, you know, we were still dating other people. And, you know, I could tell. I did know early on. I knew that she was someone special and was going to probably be not necessarily the one that early, but I had some pretty good indications pretty early that she was going to be different.
Circling a date on your coworker's calendar 2 weeks after we met, like saying, save this date because I'm going to get married that date, that really wasn't getting serious like that early on?
It really wasn't serious. I did happen to do that. It was a side story. A couple weeks after we were dating, I was talking to a woman I worked with and, you know, just telling her a little bit about, oh, I was out with this girl. We've been out a few times and she seems a little different. I said, in fact, she's probably the one. So, you know, just to make sure you're free in the future, why don't we just pick a date? And I just sort of started flipping ahead in the calendar. And then I circled September 19th. And so what was interesting was, of course, that weekend, eventually, fast forward ahead, I come in after the weekend that we get engaged and I tell my coworker, hey, you know, big news, got engaged this weekend. And sure enough, she's got that same calendar now open to that date. And she's like, well, look at this. There's a circle that said Steve's wedding. And so we didn't actually get married on that date, but we did get engaged. So. I always joke between the two of us that, you know, I'm the more romantic of the two because I was the one who always really knew. And as any guy would know, I think the real testament to this is that, you know, after Maxine and I dated for a couple of months, and she thought I was getting a little serious, so she said, hey, I think we ought to take a break. You know, at that point, as I think most guys would say, okay, fine, good, see you later, and if something comes back around, so be it. But I actually said, hey, that's fine, but you know what? I really like you. We should still be friends. Now, we all know that no guy actually ever really means let's be friends. So in Maxine's mind, that seemed okay because in her world, that was, hey, we'd go out two or three nights a week and Steve would buy me dinner and Steve would take me nice places.
I was making very little money at the time. Let's just clarify that.
She wasn't making any money. So it seemed like a pretty good gig for her. And in my mind, it was really just a matter of biding some time when we would be out until I figured eventually she would, you know, sort of come to her senses and recognize that this was it. Maxine likes to sometimes tell a story about Thanksgiving and how that sort of re-click things for
her. Yeah, you didn't have to wait that long. So Thanksgiving that same year, so this is still 1986. Steve's from Boston, as he said, and my family's from Pittsburgh. And we always had this huge family Thanksgiving dinner. We had been hanging out a lot, and I had gotten to like him. I thought he was a really nice guy. And I didn't want him to be alone on Thanksgiving. He said he wasn't going home to Boston. So I invited him to come to my parents' house for Thanksgiving dinner. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. So sitting in my parents' family room that night after dinner, watching the Cosby Show, and I remember the moment really well. There was a joke, and everybody laughed, and Steve was laughing particularly loudly, and I turned and I looked at him, and then something in my body just changed, you know, something in my heart, and I thought, okay, this is strange, but I could feel it. I could feel a difference in the way I was looking at him and the way I was feeling. So I just sat on it for a little while because, you know, I'd hurt his feelings once. I didn't want to hurt his feelings again. So I just waited for a little while. Another month went by and a group of friends, everybody was going out for New Year's Eve. We chartered a bus and we would always go to dinner somewhere that was like an hour away so that we could, you know, drink on the bus on the way out, have dinner, and then drink on the bus on the way back, and then we'd go wherever we were going. And everybody had a date for that. And I didn't have a date yet. And I didn't think Steve had a date. I wasn't sure. And I asked him if he wanted to go and be my date for New Year's Eve. And he said no, he didn't want to because he didn't do New Year's Eve with a buddy. And then I just kind of had to fess up that I was thinking maybe we shouldn't be just buddies anymore. And then the questions started. He said yes, but then he followed up with about 12 questions. Well, why did you change your mind? And what do you think is going to be different this time? And he's lucky I really ended up sitting through that all because I think he was just wanting to know why all of a sudden something changed. It was self-protection.
If you want to think of it as self-protection for me, that's cool. We can go with that.
It
was really an understanding of the whole long-term future of balance of power in a relationship, really, ultimately.
Really?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you were going to have to work a little bit because I had to work a little bit, and that was all part of that.
I just needed
to, you know, it's all good because that's why the relationship works so well.
Well, I was totally aware that you were making me work for it. I just never looked at it as a balance of power thing.
That's how it was.
Part of it, I think, was the way that Steve was so comfortable with my family. And at that point, how my family seemed to respond, because that was important to me. And then the other part of it was just feeling like I could spend a long time with him.
If you're really going to have a marriage work, you've got to have things in common that you want and goals. And I think what also helps is by then, each of us were old enough to start to at least have seen some people who got married very young and already were starting to break up. And so you start to look and learn, well, why aren't those relationships working? And for me, what I always thought was that, you know, those folks just didn't really have the same goals aligned with each other. And so I was really looking for someone that had the same value system, was going to want the same things, and would be sort of a supportive partner in all of that.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to go back to was that in that little period before I came to my senses, where Steve was waiting me out, I guess, we really became friends. My parents are really good friends, and they do a lot together. My dad's a real jokester, and, you know, he does like to laugh, and he's always made all of us laugh. And I think that in that time period, I became very comfortable with the fact that we became friends. And I thought that that was really important, and I really thought that that was a great foundation for our relationship, because no matter what, even to this day, we're still really good friends. He really can make me laugh. He has, you know, this great sense of values and integrity. He's got a work ethic that I just have always admired. I mean, I don't know anybody that works harder. And he liked his time with the boys, which I thought was really important because I liked my time with the girls. And so those were a lot of things. And after a time period, I began to really appreciate some of the romantic, silly things that he would do. Like, you know, he would leave a stuffed animal outside of my apartment door. I'd get flowers, or I remember once, you know, the song Chantilly Lace? Okay, so we were at Mario's or Blue Lou's. I can't remember which side of the bar that we were on, but we were at that bar and we were with a group of people and the song came on and Steve just sang the entire song to me. We were with a group of people. They were all at the table and he did all these like really funny, silly motions to the song. And I thought, wow, if he's not embarrassed by this, this is like, you know, amazing. And it was just sweet.
I think for me with Maxine, you know, first there's always the physical attraction, right? So she was just adorably cute and pretty and sexy and all that good stuff. And I'd like to say that I had the clairvoyance to realize that 25 years later, she would genuinely still look amazingly great, hot, and probably even better. And so I am very fortunate. I mean, that's a big win for me. But beyond that, it really was, you know, you talk about the qualities of a person, right? And Maxine was funny. She was bright. She was fun. She wasn't clingy. She was quick to say, hey, go do your thing with the guys. And so, you know, likewise, right? You know, I at least was always concerned about the girls who would, you know, want to have you with them all the time, right? I always knew that you needed to have your space. Maxine's an incredible cook. And there is some truth to, you know, the way to a guy's heart through his stomach, and at least in mine that was true. And she's an amazing cook. She's very caring and giving. And so, you know, it just was a combination of really a lot of wonderful things. And I think it's funny because, you know, you talk about things that, you know, are meaningful endorsements. And I guess, you know, in the past, it's funny when my mother would comment on girls I was dating who she'd meet. It really didn't matter. I never really cared what she thought. But this time with Maxine, it all of a sudden had a huge impact, which I think, again, reinforces I was already thinking it, right? Because it was like, wow, okay, my mom says this is the right one. Prior to Maxine and I even meeting, my mom had successfully battled cancer on a couple of stints when she was in her early 40s. She ultimately, you know, always had this sense of mortality on her end and always worried from that first point as to wanting to make sure that her kids were somehow taken care of. When she met Maxine, there was an instant click. I mean, even quicker than I knew, my mother knew this is the one. She's got a great sense. She knows the family values that we have and the kind of person that would be the right type of person to be with me. And I'll remember, you know, one night we went to a restaurant in Massachusetts that was one of my folks' favorite places. Four of us are there, and all of a sudden, you know, my mother is just, you know, go grab a table. I just want to take Maxine and introduce her to, you know, some of the folks in the restaurant.
So she grabs my hand and starts walking me around to these tables to introduce me to people. And she started introducing me as her soon-to-be daughter-in-law. We weren't engaged. There was no proposal. There was no ring. We were living together, but she was introducing me. And so people were starting then to question, oh, when are you getting married? I was laughing because his mom was just such a character and she fielded all those questions. Well, they haven't set a date yet, but it's going to be coming soon. And in the meantime, you know, I'm thinking, does she know something? I don't know. But it was just fun.
It was a couple months after that that we got engaged. And, you know, it was in September 19th was a date we had gotten engaged. I think that was probably July or so that that trip happened. And we had planned a wedding for April of the following year, which was only, you know, 6-7 months away.
And we planned it quickly because his mom really was, her health really was declining.
It was strange. It was almost like after we had gotten engaged, all of a sudden her health really went fast and she passed away in November of that year. So a couple months after we had gotten engaged. My mom was the one with all the personality, if you will, the expressive, the fun-loving type person. You know, I wish that Alyssa and Danielle would have had the opportunity to get to know their Grandma Joan. She would have loved them. You know, she'd be thrilled with the way Maxine has been as a mom. It just was a great thing.
We became a family a lot sooner than we had originally planned. Steve's a big planner, and so he had what we called the 5-year plan. We even had it written out, and we both had to sign it. He's big on doing that kind of stuff. We were going to be just us for 5 years, and then we would begin to try to have a family. But strange things happen sometimes, and it doesn't always work out the way you plan. So I was pregnant with Alyssa right before our second wedding anniversary. So it was a little sped up, I guess you would say. And we had Alyssa in December of 1990. I always wanted to have three kids. Steve wanted to have two, but we wanted them spaced apart a little bit, you know, maybe 2.5 to 3 years. So when that timing was appropriate, we started to try to have another one. And it took a long time. It was actually, you know, 10 months worth of trying till we got pregnant with Danny. And it was really joyful, but also surprising because of certain things that were going on, high stress things in our life at that time. You know, I wasn't expecting it. And it was one of the happiest days because I just didn't think it was going to happen or happen for a really long time. Alyssa was very excited to be having a sister. We found out while I was pregnant that Danny was a girl. And I did that solely because Alyssa was so insistent that if she was having a sister, that was great. But if she was having a brother, she wanted to send him back. And so I figured that I better find out so that I had time to prepare her if she was having a little brother and let her know that there is no sending back. So we did find out that we were having a girl, and so we didn't have to face that little hurdle with Alyssa. Danny came out with this full head of dark hair and screaming and made herself known right away. She's always been a person who, you know, marched to her own drum. She was a kid who really didn't get caught up into what her friends were doing. She was just aware of what she wanted to do. So from a very young age, she was firm on that. And I always thought that was a great quality to have because I knew that she wouldn't be easily influenced into things that were not good for her. I remember specifically when she was in second grade, she had an award-winning teacher, and we all loved her. In her elementary school that year, they were doing a test where the second grade class could just go to a third grade class and have all the same kids and, you know, loop it around so that they had Barb Cornaby again. They wanted to see how that worked. But the kids didn't have to do it. They could make a choice to go to a different teacher for third grade. And Danielle didn't want to. And it was really interesting because I wanted her to. But when push came to shove, we actually had to meet with the principal about it. And she just said, I love Mrs. Cornaby. I think she's a great teacher. I love my friends in my class, but I want to find out how somebody else teaches. I want to go to somebody else next year so that I can have a new and different experience and meet new kids. The principal just looked at me and I looked at him and he said, you cannot argue with that. So she went off to a different third grade teacher, had a great experience. That's one really solid example that I will never forget of her just kind of digging her heels in and saying, I'm not going with the flow. She's still like that. She'll think things through very intelligently. She'll take her time. She's very opinionated and she's fiercely loyal. Steve and I laugh all the time because she is really liberal. She's very liberal in her social thinking. She's very liberal in her political thinking. She's totally bending to the left all the time, which I like. I like her social values. You know, we have really always impressed upon the kids tolerance and, you know, accepting people as they are for who they are. Every so often, when something or someone strikes her the wrong way, she can be as judgmental as the rest of us sometimes. And I sit back and I look at her and I'm like, really, that is just so counter to the rest of your personality. You know, where does this come from? But I think that in most of those cases, those people that she seems to have that opinion about or kind of speak that way about are all people who she feels like are the popular kids in school, the ones who are the puppets, the ones who end up being a little bit of the bullies or the mean girls. She has no tolerance for that. Always try to rein her in, though, and say, you know, there's a reason for everything, and maybe that behavior is coming from someplace. They say hurt people hurt. Maybe you need to step back a little bit. I know that once she gets to college this fall, a lot of that's going to fall away because I think that she's going to be really delighted at the difference between high school and college and the way that even those kids, the stuck-up kids, the mean girls, when they get to college, I think that a lot of that goes away because everybody has the chance to reinvent themselves. She is a pop culture geek. She loves music. She loves entertainment. She loves movies. She loves television. And she knows a lot about it. She's very eclectic in what she likes to listen to. She definitely would love to work in the entertainment industry. She loves to write. She's a really good writer. She wrote this small series of books called Albert Ho-Ho. She wrote these stories about this character, his life and his challenges. And that was probably second grade, and she has written many stories since then. She's always told herself stories from a really early age. We'd see her pacing the backyard, and when she was pacing back and forth and back and forth, and we'd say, "What are you doing?" Sometimes she would say, "I'm talking to Grandma Joan." Sometimes she would say, "I'm writing a story in my head." And to this day, I will find her pacing our deck, and I just know to leave her alone, because when she's doing that, she's working an idea out. She's pacing, but she's writing and she's thinking and she's clarifying an idea for something that she has in her head. And then she'll head up to her room and she'll grab her computer and she'll just write away. I think that she would like to work in film if she eventually could, but not in front of the camera and not even behind the camera in a directing role. She loves to write and she loves to come up with ideas and be creative and kind of get that across. So I think that that might be part of her ideal job. She used to say that she wanted to be like Juliana Rancic and be on the red carpet interviewing all the celebrities. I just think that she would love that kind of a contact. Steve took her to California earlier this year and was able to introduce her to some people through a project that he was working on. So she actually got to see Lance Bass, and she got the opportunity to meet him and know him and spend some time with him. And she was at his house because that's where he produces his Sirius XM radio show. And then his guest that day was Anna Faris, and she's a huge Anna Faris fan. I think that those few days were probably the best days of her life so far, because she got to do and experience so many things that she otherwise would not have. She and I are really close. I call her my mini-me, and she calls herself my mini-me. She may look like Steve more physically, but she in personality is much more like me. She's silly in the ways that I'm silly. She's frugally irresponsible in the way that I'm frugally irresponsible. Alyssa and Steve are save, 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 save. Danny and I are spend, 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 you know, and I'm not quite sure how that all happens, but she definitely has picked up some of my negative traits as well as I think what I would hope to be some of my positive traits. And I hope that as she moves forward in life, you know, she can rein a few of those things in that it's taken me a lot longer to rein in, but she's a great person. She would always say, you can always have hope. So in whatever situation there was, like we could be heading to Kennywood Park and it would be dark and the clouds would be looming and we'd be looking going, this might not be a great day to go. And the weather forecast has said that it's going to rain. And there's this one little blue patch up there. And Danny will be the one to point that blue patch out and say, look at that blue patch. You can always have hope. And so she would always say, you can always have hope for whatever the situation was. And I love that about her because, you know, she always had that optimism in her in moving herself through situations that may at times not look as hopeful to all of us, but she would find a way to see that hope in a situation, which I think is a great quality to have.
Look, our strengths are our weaknesses, right? I mean, you know, if you really sit back and think about all the qualities, if you will, that underlie what I love in Maxine and was drawn to, come from that emotion and sensitivity. The things that she talked about with me come from that analytical, pragmatic ability to be sort of stoic and tough. And those qualities were really evident for us in facing what was, you know, really one of the big life-changing moments in our life when our daughter Alyssa was diagnosed with a brain tumor and cancer. And it was a horrific year to go through. And just for Alyssa, it was something no 8-year-old and no child should have to go through any of this. And I think that if not for the differences, you know, it's interesting. We describe them as differences and they almost sound like we're describing them as our weaknesses or our flaws, but they're really also our strengths. They're what make us complement one another. You know, in going through what we did with Alyssa, I think I needed to be able to be sort of the rock at times and get us through certain things, but Maxine needed to have every bit of that sensitivity and emotion for Alyssa.
You know, when he was up, I seemed to not be doing really well. And when he might be having a really hard day, I was really finding strength. And it just seemed to go that way. And I'm not sure whether it came about because it was necessity for survival or just really was that way and we could read each other. I always thought that we operated well together, but we came together at that period of time and became a team like we had never been a team, because it really required that. And I don't know that everybody can do that, but we really found a way, and I think that we came out of it better and stronger.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, both Maxine and I have said thousands of times, if not more, that if we could do anything to change the course of what Alyssa had to go through, we would. She's a tremendous inspiration. She's a long-term cancer survivor, but she still has to battle with a long list of disabilities and issues and things that haven't been fair to her. So in a heartbeat, we would change that if we could. But what she should also realize and know, and I'm not sure we actually tell her this enough, is in a way, there are many things that came out of that that have been important things for Maxine and I and our family, almost things that you would describe as small blessings that we've had that, again, I would erase in a heartbeat if I could change the circumstance for Alyssa. But given that can't be the case, she should know what a positive impact and influence she's had on us as parents and us as a family. You know, a lot of times families in that situation break apart. We became stronger. And who knows? I mean, you know, again, we have a wonderful life, but, you know, we're going back now almost 15 years ago out of 25 we've been married. Who knows? Had that not happened in our life, you know, Maxine and I always had our things and we always have had things we battled with. Who knows if our marriage would have succeeded the way it did? Maybe through dealing with Alyssa's circumstance and, you know, having to come together and get through that, it gives you perspective. You've heard the expression, well, it's not brain surgery. Well, we always say, well, it's not brain surgery, and we know what brain surgery really is. Right. We know what real crisis is. We know what real problems and challenges are. And so I think as we've gone through a lot of our challenging times as a couple, just maybe our getting through that and being where we are today, still married, in love, and doing as well as we do, is because when we have our problems as a married couple, we've always put it in a different perspective compared to what Alyssa's had to deal with. You know, I'd want Alyssa to know that through all of the difficulty that she's had to go through, and again, I would take it away if I could, but her circumstance caused us to learn to be a better couple. And as Maxine said, to be better people. There's no question that it was a turning point. I always say it takes a life-changing event to change your life. And what I mean by that is, you know, all of us think about how we'd like to change our lives. But it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, you know, you can want to, but actually doing it and having it be a sustainable change is a very tough thing. I think you need that life-changing event to do it. Going through what she did health-wise, without question, that changed everything for us. But there's so many positive things that have come as a result of that, you know. That
are huge parts of our life right now. Friendships that we've made and relationships that we have at Children's and things that we do that have become a huge part of who we are, what we do, how we think. I would like to think that we would be charitable giving people had that not happened, but it wouldn't be in this way. It wouldn't feel the same. I always say that when that happened, I think my soul widened, you know, and I don't think your soul widens until you go through hard times. It's the hard things that make you a better person or a person who at least has the capacity to feel more for other people who are in hard situations.
And I think we can influence others. I mean, I would say that prior to Alyssa's circumstance, I don't know that I felt like we ever had any friends that were mentors to us in that way. And I'm touched by it all the time. On average, we're probably about 10 years older than most of the other couples that are in our neighborhood. And so, you know, by age, Maxine and I kind of have been there before, right? But I think in many ways, as those folks have gotten to know us and understanding our circumstance, one thing that really is kind of nice, I think they've actually been inspired in a lot of ways to make at least some change in what they're doing. It makes their ability to enjoy and savor the success they've had so much greater. And it's not that you should do it for the reason of enhancing your own life, but that's what comes with it.
Before Alyssa got sick, as a young mom, if I were in a restaurant somewhere and I saw a child who was disabled, I always remember saying a little prayer and then saying to myself, "There by the grace of God go I," and then I did. You know, it was interesting because I always did it because you just feel like, oh my gosh, I just don't want anything ever to happen to my child. And so I would see these other parents in restaurants or wherever, and I just always remember thinking that. And then that day came. And Steve's right, nobody's immune from it, and nobody knows why it happens to who it happens to, but, you know, it just does.
I mean, you have choices. When tragic things happen in your life, you've got to try and find a way to get the silver linings out of them. If ever you did have those moments where you were thinking, I can't deal with this, this is too much, or woe me, you would look at Alyssa. Okay. And you realize that, I can't even think that way because look at her going through this and with such perseverance, and even to this day, mm-hmm. With huge numbers of obstacles that she deals with every day. Alyssa is going to college. I mean, everything that comes quickly or easily for other people will take her so much longer and be so much more difficult, but she never relents.
Because of all the disabilities that she unfortunately has, we had to remind her and remind ourselves of that choice of how you were going to live your life, especially when she was in middle school and high school. They were really crappy times for her. Her friends kind of went away. It's a hard time for anybody, let alone a kid who has those kind of challenges. And we would continually, as a family, have the dialogue of, look, it was not fair. No, it wasn't fair, but we can't change it. And since you can't change it, you can now choose how you're going to deal with it. And, I still have that talk to myself a lot. When things get hard or get difficult, you do. You have that choice to make.
As a kid, I started working at 10 years old, cutting lawns, and then I caddied. If I had ever had sons and could pick an early career for them as part of their learning, it would be to caddy. That is, without question, the best environment for, a teenage boy to be in and learn. I still remember some of their impact on me. They were out golfing and having a good time, and you could listen about where they were going to dinner and the restaurants they went to. And, I knew enough at that time to know the places they were talking about. And these were people who, obviously had been pretty successful. And you'd hear them talk business. It was really seeing that success and recognizing that, looks like they've got a pretty good life. So I guess I would tell you, when I think back and you kind of look over your professional life, I mean, my nature to begin with was to start being driven by fear of failure. As a result of fear of failing in school, I actually wound up developing study and work habits that were incredibly extreme. I went to Syracuse and had a dual major in the School of Communications and in the School of Business. And I genuinely created this study process for exams where I would start studying for exams close to 7 days ahead of a test. I would start studying for each class and I would go through all of the books and all of my notes. And it would take me probably 3 hours for each class. And I would have maybe four classes. I might spend 12 hours studying and I'd do it again, repeat the whole thing. I mean, it was really a method and process of learning. I mention that only because it was a discipline and a work ethic that I learned out of a fear that I was going to fail. I wound up graduating from college at the end of 4 years, salutatorian in my class. And it's genuinely not because I was anywhere close to the smartest guy on campus. I was a very average intellect guy, but I had a work ethic that I honestly knew was far more than anyone else. And that carried through when I got out into the professional world. Redshaw was the first company that I worked with out of college. I was up in Boston at the time in a regional sales office. I was lucky. The guy who was the VP of sales at the time, he had a group of salespeople working for him that were probably 35 to 40 years old at the time. And here I was 21. And I came along and we were introduced. He liked me. He thought that I showed, some talent. He was so frustrated with his sales force, who all had worked in sales for many years before he hired them. And so they all thought they already knew it all. And I came in and one thing I knew was I knew nothing. He really saw that as, this is my opportunity. I want to see what I can do with someone who is that total blank slate. The work ethic that I had and the way that I learned in college and had developed that skill, I really applied to this first position and learned from him. And I worked hours. I mean, he used to tell me that, I was somewhat driving crazy because I'd call him at 5 o'clock on the way back from sales calls and say, all right, I'm coming in. We need to talk about my call. Like, I couldn't wait till the next day to talk about the sales calls I had. And we would stay there till 7:30 at night with me replaying all of these things for him and him coaching me. And I would lock it in. And I would repeat it and go back. And in that same way that I learned in college, I did my own sort of dry runs of selling. And I wound up, at 23 years old, beginning to have significant financial success. So I learned that, you know, you need some talent, but hard work goes so much further. That was where high energy, high commitment, always wanting to kind of outwork the other guy, I believed in that. And as I succeeded and moved into management, especially as a very young manager and then even as a young executive, I probably, to some degree, you know, I'd like to think I was a nice guy, but I was tough. I was demanding. I just knew this is what it takes to be successful, and I expected and wanted that out of people.
You know, he was always in a position where he had people who worked for him, but they would say things to me like, oh my gosh, it is just amazing. He never sits down. He is constantly on the move, up and around. And God, he is like such a ball of energy. And the guy that I got at home would sit on the couch and have the remote. It was such a totally different person. And I would look at them and I'd be like, you must be talking about somebody else. You really can't be talking about my husband, because I can't even imagine the person you're talking about.
They were long hours. And when I would come home, I would be in shutdown mode. And it would be, yeah, just let me watch a ball game. Let me sit and flick the channel and just kind of mindlessly relax. And I never was one who wanted to then say, well, let me go out and work in the yard or, you know, the honey-do list. It was like, no, you know what? I leave it all on the field. And the time I have, I either want to spend it playing and having fun, spending it with my kids. And the other time was really about, hey, I just want to chill and relax. Yeah, it's about being happy, but whatever you want to achieve that's going to make you happy, you need to work hard to make it happen. You need to prepare.
Stephen hasn't changed. There's a side of him that I see now, the giving side. That part of him is something that I really admire. Not a lot of people that I know have that. Stephen gets most excited in life right now when he's doing something that's what I would consider philanthropic.
Well, I think for both of us, the attributes are kind of the same. They just represent themselves through sort of different paths a little bit. And so over time, you know, I think 25 years together, you do rub off a little bit. So I have gained some of the things I admired in her. She's influenced me in a positive way. And I think we've learned to really operate as a team much more now. And getting involved with other people has become a real gift for us. It's something that I don't think we realized how much personal satisfaction you could get out of it, how much fun it can be to you. And so we're, you know, coming up a couple months away from our 25th anniversary. That's sort of a milestone. Hopefully, it only marks the first half of our time together. You know, I look around and I don't think there's any couple out there that I envy as having a better relationship than the two of us. You know, we're very lucky. We have so much fun together. We think we're at a great stage. We're young at heart. We're having fun. You know, look good, feel good. We know you can't take health for granted, that you can't assume things will just be okay. It actually, to me, becomes a very important enlightenment that says, hey, don't just assume I'll get to that good fun stuff later. Embrace it now. We got pushed through experiences that forced us to have to mature. And I think of it as perspective. Everything gets seen through a different prism. And with that, it helps you become more understanding of the frailty of things in life. I talk a lot about the fact that when I turned 50, that resonated for me. It was sort of a, boy, the next 20 years, I hope I have good health. And how do I want to spend that time? What do I want to use it doing? And I think for us together, that will be a great part of what comes next. We always feel blessed in a lot of ways. Both our girls are wonderful people. They're really good kids. They're going to be great adults. But in the end of the day, I think for us, it's about measuring success in your life is really about being happy. And that's what we want for them. You know, they'll have to find their way through balancing their own desires for what they want in life and achievement. But we try and put it to them as, look, it's really just about being happy, because that's what matters most.